You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Thursday, April the 12th. We will be talking this hour and inviting your questions for Dr. Neil Barnard. Dr. Barnard is the president of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. He's the author of many books on diet and health, and we have talked to him on this program more than a few times in the past. He's going to be in Wisconsin on Monday in Milwaukee talking about reversing diabetes, a disease he says is at epidemic levels in this country. 20 million Americans, more than 20 million Americans, have type 2 diabetes. About a quarter of a million people right here in Wisconsin were diagnosed with diabetes in 2004. Dr. Barnard has come up with a program for reversing diabetes, and we'll talk about it this hour. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Toll free from anywhere. In Madison, 263-1890. 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Dr. Neil Barnard is a nutrition researcher. He's an adjunct associate professor of medicine at George Washington University School of Medicine in Washington, D.C. As I mentioned, he's the president of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine and author of many books. His very latest, Dr. Neil Barnard's Program for Reversing Diabetes, the scientifically proven system for reversing diabetes without drugs. Dr. Barnard joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Hopefully by Monday, all of our snow from our snowstorm yesterday will be gone.
Yes, let's hope so, although you can never quite tell. But nonetheless, it is mid-April. It's time for it to warm up.
That's right. And you will be in Milwaukee talking about your program for reversing diabetes. What's significant about Milwaukee and diabetes?
Well, the rates have been going up and up and up, although it's not true only in Wisconsin. It's true all over the United States. But in Wisconsin, the rates of diabetes have gone up just about 100%. What I mean to say is they have doubled in the past 10 years. And according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, one in three children born today is going to develop diabetes at some point in their lifetime. Now, in Wisconsin, there are about 70,000 children born every year. If you can imagine, one in every three of them is destined at some point to have on their medical chart that they've got diabetes. It's financially backbreaking, but personally, this is the leading cause of blindness, amputations, kidney failure. We can lose a decade of life. And none of that has to happen, none of that should happen, and none of that will happen if we can really take advantage of what we now know, not just about better and better medications, but more importantly, better diets, and that's really my message.
Yeah. Now, I looked at some of the statistics here that you provided with your book on diabetes. In Milwaukee in particular, I was interested to see that while diabetes rates are going up in the country and in Wisconsin in general, in Milwaukee it's higher than the state average?
Yes, and yet it's really astronomical everywhere in North America. And I think part of it is that we're doing the wrong thing. We know that diabetes is a condition where there's too much sugar in the blood, and the sugar is glucose, and it's supposed to be going into the cells where it acts to power them. But in diabetes, it's building up in the blood, and it attacks the blood vessels of the eyes or the kidneys or the heart. But many people then deal with it by saying, okay, if I've got too much sugar in the blood, I guess the answer is that I shouldn't eat any sugar. Or I shouldn't eat things that turn to sugar, like white bread and potatoes.
And that's not the answer?
Well, it's not the answer. It doesn't get you very far. And when people try that kind, it's a logical step, but it's not a very effective step. And if you look around the world, those people who eat the most carbohydrate, I'm talking about rural Japan or rural China, where they eat rice all day long, huge amounts of rice or noodles and starchy vegetables, they have very little diabetes. And when their rates of diabetes started rising, coincided with when the diet started westernizing, when rice gave way to burgers and fried chicken, that sort of thing. Or if a person from Japan moves to Vancouver or Seattle or, for that matter, to Milwaukee or Madison, if they adopt an American type of diet, their risk of diabetes goes up about 400%. Now, what that tells me is that this focus on carbohydrate is a mistake, that there are issues about carbohydrate, but they are not important or not the major issues in diabetes. The major issue in diabetes, in the adult onset form of the disease, is if I look inside your cells, there is the accumulation of tiny bits of fat, fat from the various foods that we eat, and that is causing the insulin that the body is making to not be able to function. And that is where we're trying to redirect attention.
Yeah, so that fat is coming from meat.
Meat, dairy products, eggs, fried foods, and maybe the occasional jar of peanut butter, that kind of thing. What it is not coming from is whole grains and beans and vegetables and fruits. Now, this was perhaps conjecture about 10 years ago, so we've started putting this kind of diet to the test. And in the mid-1990s, we did a small trial, and then more recently we've done much larger trials, where we bring people in with diabetes and we assign half of them to an American Diabetes Association diet, which focuses on carbohydrate and also tries to help people to lose weight by cutting calories. And that's sort of the current state of the art. But we, for comparison purposes, we used a vegan diet, meaning no animal products at all, keeping vegetable oils very, very low and keeping sugar low, but it was not a low-carbohydrate diet. They could have all the oatmeal and beans and pasta and yams and that kind of thing that they wanted, no calorie limit. And as time went on, the vegans clearly won. By that I mean their blood sugars were under much better control, they lost more weight, their cholesterol levels fell, and they seemed to be able to stick to it better than the people on the carbohydrate-limited diet.
Yeah, I find that kind of surprising that so many people think, you know, that it would be very hard to stick to a vegan diet, no animal products whatsoever.
It turns out to be easier than an ADA diet, and that's for two reasons. One is that the typical American Diabetes Association diet is trying to help you lose weight by reducing calories. And so if you need 2,000 calories to feel full, you're only going to be allowed 1,500. And by about Wednesday, that gets a little old because you're going to bed hungry every night. The other thing, though, is that with a vegan diet, the problem foods are just set aside. With the ADA diet, you're allowed to have a little bit of cheese, a little bit of meat, and that kind of thing. Anything can fit in the diet as long as it's not too much. The human psyche is not built for that. If I have a person who's got a problem with cigarettes, and I say, you can have a cigarette, but you can't have more than about one a day, they have tremendous difficulty with that because this is something they need to get away from, and frankly, they're physically dependent on it. But if you give them just a little bit each day, it keeps the desire for it alive. If you just say, I'm sorry, you're going to quit, the first week or two is going to be tough, but you're going to be glad that you have quit. It's easier for them. The same is true with problem foods. If I say to a person, you can have a little meat or a little cheese, it's harder for them than if I say, just set it aside and let's learn how to have oatmeal for breakfast and vegetarian chili for lunch and pasta marinara for dinner. They just set those things aside.
Yeah. Does it matter what kind of carbs you're scarfing in the vegan diet?
Yes, it does. Mm-hmm. It does. Now, but rule number one is that it's vegan because I think if we're focusing entirely on the carbohydrate and we're still eating animal products, we're really shooting ourselves in the foot. So rule number one is you throw the animal products out. That eliminates all the animal fat. It effectively eliminates cholesterol, and it eliminates animal protein. Those are all important steps for helping people with their diabetes. Step two is we keep the oils low. So if people are glugging the olive oil all over their pasta, we're going to stop that. Mm. But then when it comes to selecting carbohydrate, we use something called the glycemic index, which is you bring a group of volunteers into your research laboratory and you feed them various foods and you see which ones cause blood sugar to rise rapidly and which ones cause it to rise more gently. And the more gentle rising blood sugars, the foods that cause that more gentle rise are the ones we focus on. And it's quite simple. You avoid sugar itself. And you avoid white bread and wheat breads, generally speaking. We find that rye and pumpernickel are better. A big baking potato causes a rapid rise in blood sugar, mm-hmm. but a yam or sweet potato less so. So we just make those simple choices, but you don't have to limit carbohydrate, at least with regard to the total amount of it that you're eating.
You also, I was horrified to see that you say no peanut butter or fatty vegetables like an avocado.
Let me be clear what we're trying to accomplish here. If I stuck a needle in a person's leg and I pulled out a muscle or a muscle cell, and I looked at it under a powerful microscope, it would not look like the muscle cell of another person who did not have diabetes. The problem is this. The pancreas makes insulin. Insulin gets in the blood, and it goes to that cell where it acts like a key. It attaches to the cellular surface, and just like a key, it opens little channels that let the sugar go into the cell. And if you imagine you have a key and you have a lock and somebody has put gum in the lock, it just doesn't open anymore. Well, there's not gum in your cells, but there is fat in your cells. And as long as that fat is in there, the insulin key does not work very efficiently. So our goal is to clean that out, and I cannot clean it out if you're opening up your jar of peanut butter and taking a spoon and calling that lunch, because it's about 70% fat. I also don't believe it works if a person is saying they're hooked on salmon, which Chinook salmon is about 50% fat. And you might argue, well, I think it's good fat, isn't it? Your waistline doesn't know good from bad fat. And I don't believe the cells do either with regard to the fat that they're packing inside. So we go really low fat. We throw out all the animal products, and we keep the vegetable oils low. And that includes the avocados and the peanut butter that are oily foods, too.
The reason I said that is those are among my favorites, but I don't eat a jar for lunch or anything. But what about protein? I am someone who has a largely vegetable-based diet. I don't eat a lot of, I do eat fish. I don't eat a lot of other animal products. So I use peanut butter as one of my protein sources.
You know, the nice thing is that there are plenty of protein sources that are very low in fat. The bean group are our neglected friends, the beans. They have a lot of protein in them. They also have a lot of calcium. They have iron. They have omega-3 fatty acids, at least a little bit. They've got a lot of soluble fiber. They don't have a good lobby group. But the bean group really aims to be your friend. There's a lot of protein in grains and also vegetables. The broccoli, believe it or not, broccoli is about 40% protein. So
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I was flying once back in the days when they would provide meals on board planes more than they do now, and the foods came around and they gave me my meal, and this guy who was sitting on the window seat did not get a meal, and he said, "Well, why did you get served and the rest of us didn't get served yet?" I said, "Well, I ordered a special meal. It's a vegetarian meal, and I'm sure your meal will come in a minute." And he said, "You're vegetarian. Don't you feel kind of weak?" I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He said, "Well, there's no protein in your food, is there? And don't you feel kind of like dragged out and weak?" And I said, "Well, what is your image of strong?" And he said, "Well, strong means strong like a bull or an ox, a stallion, a gorilla, an elephant. These are all vegan animals, of course." the point being that when people eat roast beef, all thinking they need that protein, well, where did that roast beef protein come from? It came from the cow who was eating nothing but vegetation. That's a vegan animal. So if we access plant foods ourselves, we will get plenty of protein, even without special combining.
We're talking with Dr. Neil Barnard about his program for reversing diabetes. He'll be in Milwaukee on Monday night talking about this program, and you can talk to him right now at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up this afternoon, Gene Purcell in for Ben Marins. After 5, Gene and his guest will talk about procrastination and how to stop it. That's after 5. We're talking about reversing diabetes with Neil Barnard, MD. He is the president of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. He is an associate professor of medicine at George Washington University School of Medicine, a nutrition researcher, author of many books on diet and health. His latest is Dr. Neil Barnard's program for reversing diabetes, the scientifically proven system for reversing diabetes without drugs. Dr. Barnard will be at the Milwaukee Public Library Centennial Hall on Monday, this coming Monday night, April 16th at 7 o'clock. For more information on his appearance, you can call 414-286-8368. That's 216-8, I'm sorry, 286-8368. He will be talking about his program, and it looks like there will be a local chef on hand to prepare samples of the foods recommended in Dr. Barnard's program on Monday night in Milwaukee. Why do you say that? What is scientifically proven about your program, Dr. Barnard?
Well, in the mid-1990s, we began doing randomized clinical trials to test this, and starting in 2003, the National Institutes of Health supported us for doing head-to-head studies between a vegan diet and an ADA diet. And we published the results last year in one of the journals published by the American Diabetes Association called Diabetes Care. And we've presented the results at the American Diabetes Association at their annual scientific conferences. And what we've established is this. If we're tracking your blood sugar control, there's a special test we use called A1C, which shows us a good average of how your blood sugar control has been over the last 3 months or so. And we take oral medicines or insulin or make diet changes or exercise to try to drive that number down so it's not so high. And an ADA diet, the typical diet that is in use clinically now, does reduce that number to a degree. But the vegan diet, it turned out, reduced that number by about three times more powerfully than the ADA diet. As a matter of fact, the reduction was greater than that we see with any of the oral medications that are in common use today. So the diet is quite powerful, but it has some side effects that are quite desirable. It reduces cholesterol. In our study, it reduced cholesterol about 21%, and it causes a very nice weight loss, which is just the opposite of what you see with many of the diabetes medicines that cause weight gain. So we now think that diet should be our first line of defense, and it should be done very vigorously, and we suggest that this is probably the very best diet that has ever been devised for type 2 diabetes.
Our lines are packed, so let's go to the phones. Carol in Gutenberg, Iowa. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask about breakfasts, if you could give some examples of breakfast. I'm somebody who tries to stay away from sugar for breakfast.
Yes.
Because I feel so bad. So I'll eat an egg and a piece of whole wheat toast for breakfast, and that seems to be, you know, much better for me. I couldn't possibly eat a bowl of oatmeal, or I don't think that I could eat a bowl of oatmeal. So could you make some suggestions for protein breakfast?
Okay, great question. First of all, why do we want to avoid animal protein? The kidneys are sometimes assaulted by diabetes. Very commonly, about 40% of people with diabetes have a little bit of kidney function loss. And it's one of the biggest reasons why people end up on dialysis. You want to preserve your kidney function. Well, one of the biggest predictors of losing kidney function is animal protein. At Harvard, part of the Harvard Nurses Study looked at women who had a little bit of kidney function loss. The biggest predictor for them of losing more and more kidney function was whether they ate animal protein. So let's say you're having sausage. Instead of the meat sausage, have the vegetarian versions of sausage, which they now sell. In fact, they sell it not just at health food stores, but regular groceries. If you're having oatmeal, have, instead of the instant, which will cause your blood sugar to spike, and then where you're running into trouble is when your blood sugar starts falling back down. That makes you feel out of sorts. The old-fashioned oatmeal causes a much more gentle rise. It's a lower glycemic index food and is a very good choice for you.
It sounded like she didn't like oatmeal.
If that's the case, you might try a little bit of cinnamon or raisins or something like that. But if what you're afraid of is that it seems to you like a low-protein, high-carb food, and you think, gee, I won't feel sustained, I think that can be true with the instant varieties. It's much less likely to occur with old-fashioned. By the way, you don't have to have a half hour to cook it. It cooks in about 3 or 4 minutes right in your microwave if you're in a hurry. And if you do it on the stove, maybe 5 minutes, not longer than that.
Yeah. What about the soy protein, the vegetable protein that's in those sausages? We hear that may not be something we want to eat every day.
Well, I'm not recommending that people have to have a soy protein sausage. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I'm not recommending against it either. It beats the socks off the regular variety of sausage. Mm-hmm. If you see what goes into those things, if you know what I'm talking about.
Right, yeah, and I don't eat those either. But then what about the concerns that too much soy will whack my hormones out of balance and may not be good for me?
There are websites that allege that sort of thing. I think they're mixing up the science a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Soy does have hormones in it, very weak hormones called phytoestrogens. In women prior to menopause, at least, they actually have an anti-estrogen effect. what they do is, because they are so weak, they're nothing like the estrogen in your body. They're extremely weak, and yet they're able to attach to the estrogen receptors on your cells, and that actually displaces your natural estrogen a little bit, so they have a helpful anti-estrogen effect and are believed to be part of the reason why breast cancer rates are so low in countries that eat a lot of soy. Now, having said that, soy is a very, very nutritious protein, and I think you can overdo it with any of these sorts of things. So I would encourage people to not go crazy with anything that's quite as nourishing as soy is, because you don't need that much protein in your diet.
Thanks a lot to Carol. We go next to Paul and Nina. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Good morning, Joyce. Good morning, Dr. Barnard. How are you doing this morning?
Hi. Just fine. Good morning.
Thank you. I have high blood pressure, and I take a pill every day, a couple pills, actually. And I've been eating oatmeal in the morning, and I'm taking vitamins, gamma sylvester and Q10 and ginkgo and whatnot. I'm overweight. I'm trying to lose weight. It's kind of a difficult journey. And I'm getting, you know, kind of pains in my feet. But my main two questions, basically, is I have the cravings for meat, and I can't seem to avoid. I mean, I cut it back, and I try to eat other things, but it's just, I got to have a hamburger every other day or a pizza once a week, and I try to cut that back. And the top number, the blood pressure, just won't come down. What can I do to address these issues?
Okay. First of all, you're making me a little bit nervous. I hope you have a good doctor that you see. And I would encourage everybody who has diabetes, who is listening to this program, make sure you've got a good relationship with your healthcare provider. Because you said you not only have diabetes, you have hypertension, and you've got neuropathy. Mm-hmm. That's a complication that means your diabetes is serious business. Let me describe something, though, that I think might make you feel a little bit more optimistic. There was a man who came into our study named Selwyn. He had had diabetes for 21 years, and what he had was not only were his eyes affected, but he also had painful neuropathy. And this is going to sound familiar to you. The blood sugar attacks the nerves that are going to the legs and the feet. And he had burning pain in his feet. And night after night after night, he had to put up with this terrible pain. And there is no medicine that reliably makes it go away. And it gets worse and worse and worse and worse. And as you know, people often end up with amputations because they don't feel the damage that's happening to their feet. You don't want to go there. Anyway, Selwyn came in. He did the diet that is vegan, low-fat, low-glycemic index. Not only did his blood sugars fall and his insulin came down, but about 6 months into the study, he said, you know, my neuropathy is gone. And I said, well, let me make sure I understand. Your neuropathy is a lot better. And he said, no, my neuropathy is completely gone. Now, that shocked him, but it didn't surprise me because in the 1990s, a researcher named Milton Crane showed that if you use a vegan diet plus vigorous exercise, the neuropathy is gone in about 2 weeks in about three-quarters of patients. So this is not a time to fool around. Mm-hmm. I would wave a magic wand and tear you away from meat and dairy products and oils and things tomorrow. But because you're saying, well, I have a craving, how do I do that? I have two steps. The first step, you take about a week and you look at your options. If you like to cook, I've got recipes for you. If you go fast food, Burger King will sell you a veggie burger, Taco Bell will sell you a bean burrito. You figure out what your choices are. Then the second step is you take 3 weeks, only 3 weeks, and you have every meal be one of the meals that you know you like, but that happens to be vegan and low in fat. You just take it for a test drive. You haven't sworn off anything forever. At the end of 3 weeks, two things happen. One is you feel better and your blood sugar is better, but the other thing is your tastes change and you no longer want to go back to that double bacon cheeseburger.
Good luck, Paul. Thanks for calling. Elena in Milwaukee is next. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to say, well, I am vegan, and I'm 20 years old. I'm a college student, and I just wanted to comment. A couple of these callers have been saying that, you know, it seems really difficult, and you get that a lot as a vegan. People think that it's really difficult to live that way, and people think that it's really expensive. And I just wanted to say that, I mean, me being a college student, I obviously don't have a whole lot of money, and it's incredibly easy these days to find all sorts of options with a vegan diet. And I know you said you're offering recipes, and also there's a really easy website that has all vegan recipes, and it's vegweb.com. And so that also is a pretty useful tool for people, so I just wanted to get that out there.
All right.
thank you for mentioning that. It is the kind of thing that everybody imagines it's hard. But then as soon as they do it, they think, why didn't I do this a long time ago? It's quite easy. It's very much like you're going to the swimming pool, and it's August, and you know you want to jump in, but is the water a little cold? once you get in, you discover it's lovely, and you wish you had been doing it a long time ago.
We'll go now to Brian in Milwaukee. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I had a couple of comments. I've been a type 1 diabetic since 1972, so I've been walking the tight wire for pretty much my whole life. I'm 47 now. I'm in great health. I have no body fat. And I think that what the big thing that's missing in this conversation is just the good sense people don't take. I would like the doctor to comment, if he could, if they've done any research on income levels and education levels, because I live in a poor neighborhood and I see a lot of obese people eating garbage, and I can't help but think that this is where a lot of this problem lies. I mean, what I have, I couldn't help. I was born with it pretty much, but I think a lot of this stuff is just brought on, and not enough emphasis on exercise. I mean, I eat pretty much whatever I want because I exercise all the time, and I see these people just getting obese, eating donuts and drinking, washing it down with the soda, and they say they have type 2 diabetes, and I'm almost offended as a type 1 diabetic because I think am I making any sense? And I'm wondering if you put any thought or effort into looking at the income levels of the people that have type 2 diabetes and the education levels, because I believe firmly that if you look at that data, I bet it goes way up as you go down those two particular ladders.
Well, I think you're making a good point in that education is really an important part of this. And I think that it's certainly true that we need to reach all parts of society with this. But I have to say, I was lecturing the other day at a medical school in New Orleans, and the entire audience was medical professionals and doctors in training as well. And you know what? They're very much like lay people when it comes to nutrition. So I have to lay it out simply to them. We carry with us a lot of perhaps nutritional myths and a lot of feelings about what we grew up with. You know, personally, I grew up in Fargo, North Dakota, so I ate roast beef, baked potatoes, and corn every day of my life. And we then sort of equate that with some sort of nutritional wisdom, or we think that our body needs those sorts of things. But the point I'm making is this. I think you're right, we need education. I don't think it's limited to one segment of the population. I think the whole population needs to be re-educated and needs to also try out healthier foods so that they can speak from experience. A doctor who has never had a vegan meal for a day in his or her life is not a very good advocate, any more than a doctor who's got a pack of cigarettes in his lab coat pocket is not very persuasive when he tells a patient to quit smoking.
Yeah. Is your program only directed to those with type 2 diabetes?
Oh, great question. No, it's also directed to people with type 1. The difference is, if a person has type 2, they may well get off their medication. Or if they're on insulin, they may well be able to get off it. Not necessarily everybody, but most people are able to reduce medicine. Some of them get off it. If you have type 1, you'll continue to need insulin because your body has lost its ability to make it. Mm-hmm. But what the program does is it reduces the amount that you need, and it greatly diminishes your complications. The caller was saying, well, he eats anything he wants, but he exercises it off. Exercise will bring down your blood sugar, and it'll help bring down your weight, but it will not stop the assault on your heart. So I would encourage the use of a low-fat vegan diet, even for a person with type 1. And the last thing is, dairy product exposure to infants has been suggested as one of the triggers for type 1 diabetes. The infants are designed for human breast milk, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Cow's milk proteins in some children elicit the production of antibodies that are believed to be one of the triggers for type 1 diabetes. There are others like genetics and viruses. But this has been a theory that's been around for a long time, and there's substantial evidence supporting it. So I'm suggesting that if people follow the kind of diet that I'm describing, and children were brought up without cow's milk products, that we might be able to reduce the risk of type 1 diabetes.
Mm. Interesting. Coincidentally, Dr. Barnard, in our last hour, we were talking about corn. Let's make a long story short. And we're talking about the increase in the use of like high fructose corn syrup in everything practically that's processed and diet and sodas. How much is that contributing to this problem, do you think?
I think it does contribute in the sense that there are sort of stealth calories that are insinuating their way into foods. And if you have a bottle of water that you bought at the store, you don't particularly need it flavored up and sugared up and sweetened, you know, and all that kind of thing. And it's true. Having said that, I think we sometimes defend our most risky dietary habits by looking for scapegoats. And while I do think that high fructose corn syrup is a problem, it's not the biggest problem, and it's similar to trans fats. You have New York has banned trans fats in restaurants. That's a good move. But Americans eat four or five times as much saturated fat as they do trans fats, so they can beat up on the fryer grease while they ignore the cheese and the meat and the chicken fat that really are the bulk of their diet. So that's where I think our attention needs to go first. And then the high fructose corn syrup and so forth is something we never needed and we could throw out easily.
What if you're drinking non-fat milk, skim milk?
Well, milk is a watery base. Mm-hmm. And the primary nutrient in whole milk is fat. It's about 49% of its calories and mostly saturated fat. So people are quite right to skim that off. But then what's left? The primary nutrient in non-fat milk is sugar, just lactose sugar, and that's 55% of its calories. Then there's some animal protein in there that nobody needs, and then there's that bit of calcium, which is its selling point. Well, you can get plenty of calcium from green leafy vegetables and legumes, and you don't need the milk for that purpose.
We're going to continue taking your calls for Neil Barnard. He is the author of many books. His latest is Dr. Neil Barnard's Program for Reversing Diabetes. He will be in Milwaukee on Monday night, this coming Monday night, April 16th. We'll be at the Milwaukee Public Library Centennial Hall at 7 p.m. You can talk to him right now by calling 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Stay tuned. Coming up, Peter Donald's in for Kathleen Dunn. A report from the International Red Cross says civilian suffering in Iraq is increasing. Peter and his guests, after 9, will examine the struggling humanitarian effort in Iraq, as well as the conditions of thousands of refugees who have fled to neighboring countries. Two more questions for Dr. Neil Barnard about his program for reversing diabetes, and Bonnie in Madison is next. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I was calling because I'd like to have the guest comment on the Weston Price Foundation's approach with Sally Fallon. I'm wondering if he's familiar with that.
Thank you for your question. No, I'm not really terribly familiar with it.
Weston Price was a dentist, I believe, in the early 20th century, and
yeah,
he looked at...
You know what, Bonnie, I'm not sure that we want to go into somebody else's, a program right now.
I'm wondering, it's contradicting what the doctor suggested.
How so? Saying that animal products are fine? Or?
Right, raw milks, organic butters, lard, and olive oil. It's not interested in canola oil. It's not interested in hydrolyzed proteins and things like that. But I'm also wondering, because today I just started the Fat Flush program, and I didn't know if the doctor was familiar with that, because I had been a vegan as a young adult. I grew up in central Minnesota with a lot of meats. But when I became pregnant with our first child, I needed animal fats. I knew that this was my husband's child because he's a carnivore to the end, and I thought I could convert him, and then I was carrying his child, and I was craving meat.
What about pregnant women and the diet you're promoting, and whether maybe animal-based products would be okay in that situation?
Okay, well, these are all good questions. I'm glad you raised them, and I should be clear that when I write a book of this type, or if we're talking about these things, these are diets that we've actually put to careful clinical tests. And we have done tests in the past where we allow people to include a small amount of meat or animal fat in them. And I have to say, people do not do nearly as well. There's a dramatic difference. They just don't succeed as well as they do with the diet that I'm describing here. And so that's the reason I don't recommend that a person include lard or meat or any of those things at all. I really think we're shooting ourselves in the foot with that. And I have to say that during pregnancy, if we rely on our cravings as a guide to what is good for us, you can almost throw the rules to the wind, because the cravings that occur during pregnancy are related more to hormonal shifts, and they're not a very good reliable guide to what we need. And certainly, people who eat no animal protein at all, people who are, or no animal products, people who follow vegan diets during pregnancy, they actually have fewer complications. They do much better. And they're also less likely to get the type of pregnancy of diabetes that occurs during pregnancy, which is called gestational diabetes. So I would encourage you to not consume the animal products during pregnancy or, frankly, any other time. I do have one other suggestion, though, and that is during pregnancy and at any other time of life, I think it's a sensible thing to take vitamins. They're the prenatals if you're pregnant, but regular, basic, multiple vitamins at any other time. That will provide you vitamin B12, which is not very plentiful in vegan foods. There are vegan sources like nutritional yeast, but you're probably missing those. So multiple vitamins are good, and they'll make sure that you've got good nutrition.
Yeah, and taking vitamin B12 in a supplement, is adequate?
Yeah, absolutely. With one exception, there are people who cannot absorb vitamin B12 from their digestive tract, and it doesn't matter what they eat. It doesn't matter if they're a meat eater, vegetarian. It doesn't matter if they're supplementing or not. They just can't absorb it. It's due to a disorder of the stomach, and they need shots.
Diane in Madison is with us now. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I'm a type 2 diabetic, and my dietitian told me something. She put me on a 45 milligram per meal, 3 times a day regimen, and she said that what I need to do is I need to have a meat protein and also a carbohydrate together. And she said what that does, she said, is to assimilate the food better in the body and therefore being easier on the pancreas during digestion.
Is it working for you? How is it working?
Well, I'm not a real meat eater. I'm not real keen on meat. And I don't really care for fish. And so what I've been trying to do is I've been trying to eat the vegetarian-type meat with the carbohydrate, but I don't like potatoes.
Okay.
So I'm trying, like, couscous and that kind of thing. I'm experimenting.
So you're not following your doctor's advice to have a meat, an animal protein, Diane?
No, not really, because sometimes it upsets my stomach.
Sure, sure. Well, what you're describing it sounds similar to the American Diabetes Association teaching tool where they have what they call exchange lists, where they'll say, have your carbohydrates, have it with proteins, and they'll have fats and other things in certain amounts, and they encourage combinations of these. We have tested that sort of diet in a clinical trial where we used that and compared it to the vegan diet. And I think you might like the vegan diet better because it's more effective at controlling blood sugar, and it also is easier for you. If you're not in the mood for meat, well, we're leaving meat out. And if you want to have more or less of any given foods that are allowed, there's no calorie limit. There are no portion sizes. You eat as much of them or as little of them as you want because all of the foods are healthful foods for you. There isn't anything in the vegan diet that you need to limit.
Sounds like Diane would prefer that anyway, though.
Yeah, I suspect that you would enjoy it. Yeah. So rather than forcing yourself to have meat or something like that, frankly, your coronary arteries are glad that you're not going to have it.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Dr. Barnard, did I miss? What do you think of that advice? Put this protein and carb together. That's going to aid in digestion. She said specifically an animal protein. Is that what doctors are telling?
I hope they're not saying that. Mm-hmm. If I have plant-based foods, they're always mixtures of protein and carbohydrate. And there are little tiny traces of fat, but not much. And then there's lots of fiber and vitamins. So you get these combinations naturally. But the digestive tract has a way of sorting that out and absorbing what it needs along the way. And it pulls in the proteins and pulls in the carbs and pulls in the fats, too.
We are talking about Dr. Neil Barnard's program for reversing diabetes. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. And our next caller is Bill in Milwaukee. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hello. I was diagnosed about 3 years ago with type 2 diabetes. My doctor called me at home and told me to sit down, that my fasting blood sugar was about 225. And I went in and had an A1C, and it was 8.2, I believe, something like that. I was pretty crestfallen to hear this, but I was about 100 pounds overweight, and this weight had kind of crept up on me over the course of several years. I went home And just the doctor wanted me to go on medication, and I said, give me 3 months. I went home and threw out most of what was in my kitchen cabinets, and fortunately, I love vegetables and fruit. I loaded my refrigerator with vegetables and fruit, and I ate as much as I wanted all the time. And I went back to my doctor. I had lost about 35 to 40 pounds. My A1C was 5.6. My cholesterol was down dramatically. My triglycerides were down dramatically. And I've gone on now to, I've lost 80 pounds, and I've got another probably 25 or 30 to go. I feel much better. I'm much more awake. And now I have, with the weight off, I can really start exercising much more actively. So I really appreciate what you're saying. I'm a strong proponent of this.
Well, congratulations. Mm-hmm. You've done wonderfully. And you know what? So often when people go on medications early on, they do so for a sensible reason, because they know that if they maintain a high blood sugar for a long period of time, it can assault their eyes and their kidneys and so forth. And yet at the same time, many of the medications that are used for diabetes cause weight gain. So instead of happening, instead of experiencing what happened to you, they experience a gradual worsening of their condition in certain ways. Their weight goes up and up and up. But you've done terrifically. You've gotten to the cause of it, which is dietary, and you're losing weight. You're doing great. So congratulations. That's wonderful.
Getting a number of emails, Dr. Barnard, related to fats, and I'm going to try to consolidate this a little bit. Somebody wondering, don't we need some fat? Don't demonize fats. What about... aren't oils needed to absorb nutrients? Talk about what your program calls for in terms of oils or fats. I mean, you said don't pour on the olive oil, but a little olive oil is okay. What do you call for?
Okay, we're not demonizing mm-hmm. them in the sense that we're not casting moral aspersions on them, but we are but we are pointing out that biologically they're not helping us, and they're part of the problem. You do need a certain amount of fat, but you only need perhaps 2 to 3% of your calories from fat. You don't need more than that. And in olive oil is actually quite low in the essential fats that the body really needs. What it's big with is something called monounsaturated fat that is marketed as being sort of neutral for your cholesterol level. But about 13% of the fat in that bottle of olive oil is plain old saturated fat. And so on balance, it's really not helping. And where fats really are a big problem, any kind of fat, animal fat or vegetable oil, is that they're very calorically dense. By that I mean every gram of fat's got about 9 calories in it. Every gram of carbohydrate has only 4. So the more fat I pack into my diet, the harder it is for me to keep the calories down and to keep weight off. So you do need a certain amount of fat in your diet, that's true. There are traces of fat in beans and grains and vegetables and a little bit in fruits and so forth. If a person wants to add a little bit more in the form of some walnuts or soy products or flax oil or something, they will boost their omega-3 a little bit. I'm not entirely sure that people really need that, though.
But other than that, you're saying no oils in cooking and that sort of thing.
Well, what I'm saying is this, is that if a person's goal is to keep their weight down, mm-hmm. the more they have the grains and beans and vegetables and fruits, and the more they keep the oils out of their diet, and obviously setting aside the animal products completely, the more success that they're likely to have.
Next we go to Jack in Whitewater. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks a lot. Two questions. One, are you saying that this needs to be done across the whole American population? And if not, where is the line? And secondly, are you or anyone else working on a selective encapsulation system where we can eat what we want, but the things that would hurt us would be encapsulated and wouldn't affect us? Thank you.
Okay. The first question was, should everybody do this? For a person who's got diabetes now, according to our results and others who have made similar studies, this is the best diet to follow. If a person's at risk for diabetes, it also seems to be useful for preventing it. And if a person just does not want to get heart disease, or if they want to keep their cancer risk low, we've known for a very long time that vegetarians have about 40% less cancer risk compared to other people. That's perhaps because meat is linked to colon cancer, dairy products are linked to prostate cancer in epidemiologic studies. So we're skipping those foods, and our risk is less. if children were raised on this type of diet, they do seem to do better than other kids. So I think the answer is, yeah, I think a vegan diet is a healthful diet for people. Regarding the encapsulation thing, I'm afraid I didn't quite understand that question.
I didn't either, and we need to move on. That caller is gone. Maggie in Brookfield, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. From what I'm hearing, this sounds like it would be a good diet for children and the family as a whole.
Yes.
And if you did this, how would you implement it when you have babies who always have to have milk?
Okay, well, that's great. Well, babies, first of all, ideally should be breastfed. And if they're breastfed, they get a couple of extra IQ points. Their risk of diabetes later in life is lower. Their immune function is better. So breastfeeding is good. There are challenges with it sometimes, but we should do what we can to overcome those challenges. After the age of weaning, there isn't actually a requirement for milk in the child's diet at all anymore. They will need calcium, of course, and calcium is in beans. It's in green vegetables. And if your child... You don't want to arm wrestle with children. So if they don't like broccoli when they're 7 or 8, but they like green beans or corn, or you give them the ones that they like, and you set aside the things that are not so healthful. They should be taking a multiple vitamin just like adults should as well.
Yeah, the program, generally, there are foods that you should not worry about at all. It was besides fruits and vegetables, what are some of the things that we can, enjoy?
Yeah. Okay, well, I use four food groups. Those are the whole grains, beans, but the bean group includes lentils and peas also, and then vegetables and fruits. Now, those are ingredients. So what that translates into is spaghetti is a grain product, of course, and it's topped with tomatoes, which are vegetables or fruits, depending on how you define them. If I make a vegetable chili, it might be a mixture of beans and vegetables and things. And you put these together, and you have actually what are the staples of most cultures in the world. By the way, I might mention, for people who are thinking, I'd like to do this, but I'd like a little support, let me mention our website, if I may,
Sure. Which
is pcrm.org. That stands for Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, pcrm.org. Click on the diabetes icon. You'll see information about this new book, but also we have an online live support group for you. And as a matter of fact, 3 o'clock today, click online, and I'll be there. We'll be talking, and we can take your comments live online if you have high-speed internet.
Well, good. That's a great way to end the program. If people want to continue the conversation, 3 p.m. this afternoon on your website.
Yes, pcrm.org.
Thanks a lot.
Sure. Thank you.
Dr. Neil Barnard, his latest book, Dr. Neil Barnard's Program for Reversing Diabetes, a scientifically proven system for reversing diabetes without drugs. Dr. Barnard will be in Milwaukee this coming Monday night, Monday, April 16th, 7 p.m. He'll be talking at the Milwaukee Public Library. For more information on that appearance, 414-286-8368. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing the hour and to Leo Duran for on-air production. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.